Welcome to our podcast for Raising Arizona Kids Magazine. I'm Vicki Belind. This month, Scottsdale pediatrician Arturo Gonzalez will end his term as board president of the Arizona chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. He talks about how his own childhood health issues laid the groundwork for his intense curiosity about medicine. Dr. G also weighs in on today's childhood obesity epidemic, his take on why parents hesitate to vaccinate, and how the AZAAP is working to become a voice for Arizona's children.
My name is Arturo Gonzalez. I'm a pediatrician here in Scottsdale, Arizona. I practice at Scottsdale Children's Group, and I've been doing it for, over 19 years now.
So, Dr. Gonzalez, what are your earliest memories of visiting the doctor yourself?
They're not good. I hate to say that. They're not very good. I literally cried en route to the doctor's office, in the waiting room, and in the entire visit, according to my mother, which she used to tell me that. So it wasn't that good. But ironically, maybe because I went there so many times, that kind of influenced me a little bit to think about medicine, which is kind of, I know, doesn't make any sense.
So you went many times because?
Yes. When I was born, I had congenital hip dysplasia. I was a little kid. So that means that your hip dislocates, if you will. And unfortunately, my pediatrician missed it. It was a sad reality for my parents at that point.
Was that here locally? Or?
No, it was in Nogales, Arizona, where I was born.
Okay.
Because of that, I had many, many visits to the doctors, not just my pediatrician, but to orthopedic doctors. And I remember my mother even saying that I went to several orthopedic doctors because one would tell them one thing, and my parents were not happy with it. They would go to another doctor and so forth. Make a long story short, I ended up having surgery after three failed, almost full body casting. They casted me from maybe a little bit higher than the hip all the way down. And the hope says that if I get casted, you know, they put you in an angle that the hip will set in place and that I would never need a surgery. Well, after three failed attempts, I ended up having surgery. And that was maybe when I was about a year and a half of age.
So all of this was going on when you were a very young child.
I was a baby, yes.
Do you have any memory of that?
I actually do, and I'll preface it by saying this. I remember asking my mother, and I said to my mother this way, "Mom, please don't interrupt me. Let me just tell you this to see if it's my memory or you told me this, and I remember it as such." And I started describing the hospital where I got physical therapy after my surgery. And I said, I remember it was a big, long room that had the windows on top, right at the edge. It was very bright. It was in the summer months. And as I'm saying this, I could see my mom almost teary-eyed.
Hmm.
And I said, I remember there was a very nice nurse that she always bring me candy, you know, and there was a sandbag at the end of the table attached to my leg, so it was pulling the leg, if you will. That's how, I mean, this was
this is what they 50, did then.
So this is what they yeah. did then, right? And I also remember, and my mom, at this point, she's getting really teary-eyed. And I said, and I also remember there was like a choo-choo train on the outside. And because I was basically bound to the bed, they literally would wheel me out so I can see the other kids in the choo-choo train because I couldn't get in it. After I told her that, she said, absolutely, I've never told you that. And I must have been between 1.5 and 2. And I know people say, well, there's no way you can remember that. I clearly remember that, as I'm telling you now, I remember it as well.
You have a picture in your mind.
I have a picture in my mind, and it was a very nice, good picture, though.
So, I mean, thinking of that, that must be kind of a window into how children think and believe and behave for you as a pediatrician.
Absolutely.
You have those memories, and so that must make you realize or you think about the awareness that a 1.5-year-old would have of life reality and things that are happening to them. And as a pediatrician, that's valuable to know about.
Absolutely. In fact, I actually do that on purpose. I ask those questions because I want to find out if I was the only one who can remember that far, you know, into my childhood. And most people would say, well, I remember things at 4 or at 3. And either it's a bad memory or a very good memory because those are like embedded in our brains. So there's got to be something to it. Because if you think about it, you know, if I ask you right now, what is your youngest memory that you have? Obviously, we remember something between 1 and 4 because we recognize grandma and houses and all that stuff. But if I ask you to remember that, You probably don't remember a lot of those. So I don't know if it's like it's a clean slate. Do we erase the hard drive in our brains and we start anew at 4 years of age? I don't know that.
Right.
But it's always intrigued me and interests me.
And those very young children that you're seeing in your office, one, one and a half, two, maybe they're going to have a memory, or maybe they're going to, you know, they're really more aware of what's going on than you think.
I agree completely with that one. In fact, I tell parents, be cognizant of all the things that you do for your children. You're creating memories, good or bad. If they come to the office and they had a bad experience, believe you me, we will remember that. Kind of like what I just said, you know, the way I remembered my first visits to the doctor. But then it got to a positive thing. So when I got better, I all of it is very, very nice after that.
So kind of some of that kind of led you to think about medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me a little bit about how that happened.
Well, I've always been interested in science, even at a younger age. I was one of those kids that I would ask Santa Claus, for example. I said, Santa, I want a microscope, or I want a chemistry set, or I want... My brothers and sisters thought I was a dork. And believe me, I'm the second of 11, you know. So, but I would get my microscope. Yeah, I've got it's a big family. I do have a big family. The second of 11. So I would get my microscope. I would get all my chemistry set. And I would do all these little, tests and all this stuff in my backyard. I grew up in Nogales, and our backyard back then was the woods. So I would literally hunt for lizards and all get these poor little animals, poor little creatures that crossed my path. And I'm sorry to say that for those animals, but I did surgery on these little animals.
Oh, you did?
Oh, yes.
Where do you think that drive came from?
Probably from...
Or curiosity.
The curiosity is probably from me being in the hospitals, in clinics, you know. So I have to have had some good memories, you know, embedded in the bad memories where I was in pain. Because there's nobody in my family there's a doctor. There's no family cousins or anything like that are practicing doctors at all. I was the first one in my family that to do that. There were four things that I wanted to do when I was a little kid. You know, I knew that there was one little kid. I wanted to be a doctor. I wanted to wear glasses. I wanted to be 35 years old. And I wanted to change my name to George. I became a doctor. I actually became a pediatrician at 35 years old, which is kind of eerie, which is kind of cool, though. I don't wear glasses anymore because I had RK surgery, but I wear my cheater glasses, so I'm wearing glasses again. And I don't like the name George. You know, 3 out of 4 ain't bad. You know, I've never changed my name. I don't know where the name George came up, but I wrote it on a napkin when I was a little kid.
So what was the path to become a doctor at 35?
Well, I went to school in Guadalajara. You know, all my brothers and sisters went to U of A. I wanted to be as far away from the house as possible. And back in the 70s, Guadalajara in Mexico was kind of like an adventure, and it was kind of nice. So I went there for prep school. I went through medical school there as well. And I practiced, when I graduated, I practiced for 3.5 years. And actually in both the Nogales border on the Mexican side and the American side, so I kind of donated my services to a little Catholic dispensary that they had in the Mexican side, which is really rewarding. I remember that fondly. Then after 3.5 years of practicing adult medicine, I was never comfortable with it. I thought that, okay, so my first year is the honeymoon period. You know, maybe I don't know what it is to be a doctor. By the second year, I'm like, I really don't like this. By the third year, I'm like, God, I dreaded even going to the office. That was adult medicine. No disrespect to those who practice adult medicine,
sure.
Because I'm glad that there's people, I have my own doctor that takes care of me for that reason. But I've always loved children. I've always had a knack for making kids laugh and smile, and I've always said that. And it reminded me again when I was a little kid. What really prompted me to think about pediatrics is the fact that I had congenital hip dysplasia, and I wanted to make sure that another kid that I would diagnose would not go through what I went through. That actually truly happened. The first time it happened, I couldn't even hold the tears back because I'm like, okay, this kid's not going to go through what I went through. And the parents, like, I would tell the parents, I go, let me tell you my story. So I would tell them the story. They were very grateful. And that, so it's almost as corny as it's on the circle of life, I actually already had that experience in a very good way.
Let's talk a little bit about children's health issues today. What's your biggest concern?
My biggest concern is the access to care. I mean, I understand the state of the economy in our state and across the nation. But we have to think about our children. They're our future. I even tell my patients when I examine them, I says, I want you to do very well and study well because one of these days, Dr. G is going to be an old geezer and you may be taking care of me. I want smart people out there. I don't want dumb people and healthy people. So the access to care is a big, big issue. The appropriate care also is the other one. You know, with the health care reform and all the thing that is going on, I hope they would do the right thing, and especially for children.
What stands in the way? What are some of the barriers for children to get good health care?
The barriers, it's always about money, unfortunately. You know, it's to divert money from one program to another that affects kids, I will never understand that. And it is about money, unfortunately. The barriers are people think that, you should work hard for it and you should pay for your own medical expenses and so forth. Well, not everybody can do that. Not everybody is as lucky as we are. So the barriers are people, and the barriers is money, and the barriers is access. Those are the three big barriers that I see.
So how has the role of pediatrician changed or evolved since you started practicing?
It's become more of a business model. When I started practicing, and it's exciting because you're learning and you feel like you're making a difference. I still feel like that, though. But now it's about the business end of it as well. It's really sad because, for example, with vaccines. I'll give you an example of vaccine. Vaccines are one-third of our overhead. And if doctors can't afford vaccines, you know, to have them in their own offices, then children may not get their vaccines in that office. We would have to send them to county health centers or Maricopa County, in this case, here in Phoenix. And we hope that actually the parents actually take them to get vaccinated. So that's part of that, and that's how it's changed. In a good way, though, I've even said to my partners, you know, I'm actually enjoying pediatrics more now because I've known these people, in my case, for 19 years. So I've seen the families. I've grown with them. I know exactly what their teenager is doing or not doing. And the best reward that I've had in the last year, year and a half, is that now I'm seeing second-generation children. So the patients that I saw that were little kids, they must have been, if it was 19 years ago, let's say they were 5 and they're in their early 20s, they've gotten married, they have their babies, and they bring them to me. That is the biggest, best reward that we get.
So you're finishing out your position as board president of the Arizona AAP.
Correct.
American Association of Pediatrics. So how have you used the board position, or what's sort of your legacy?
I guess what we've done in the last 2 years with the help of everybody, because it's never going to be about me, it's about all of us that we've done at the chapter, is that the chapter is recognized. The chapter is out there. It's the exposure to the media, to the legislators. Now we're forced to reckon with, and I'm proud to say that, in a sense that when there's any issues occurring, whether it's at the state legislature or at the hospitals or whatever it is, we are asked to be part of it. So we ask for advice, which is amazing. You know, our organization, active members is over 600 of a potential 900 members. But we are out there. That, if there's a legacy that I can say that, is the exposure of the Arizona chapter of the Academy of Pediatrics to not only just our state, but national. We have been recognized nationally for several of the programs that we've done here. So that's I'm very proud of, just of the team effort that we've all done.
Is Arizona a little late to the game to have a local chapter for a state? Do most states have chapters that are active?
Every single state has an active chapter. Now, how active they are, you know, you have to look into each one of them. The way it works with the National American Academy of Pediatrics, every state has their own chapter, and then they're divided in districts. So you've got the Western District, there's 10 districts, if you will. Within each district, it encompasses all the states within the district, so each one of them have that.
So the idea is, if you're a local chapter or a state chapter, that there is power in numbers. You can be looked at as consultants or experts in the field for children. So you're better able to advocate for children?
Absolutely. And the best part of it, as I mentioned, there's over 600 of us. I wish more of would get active, because there's so many untapped resources out there, people that are smart and brilliant in certain topics. We've been fortunate enough that within our own board members, we have a great variety of people in our own board. When I became president, if you will, we joined forces between the programs that we had and the committees that we had, and we expanded the board. Now the board encompasses people not just only from urban or suburban areas, from the rural areas as well. And we have, as of a week ago, we proposed also to get the business community involved in it as well. So we have representation from small practices, large practices, urban, suburban, and rural. So we really represent the state. This was the whole purpose of what we wanted to do.
And how does that translate to, say, the family with a couple of kiddos?
Right. We have several programs. For example, Reach Out and Read is an organization that promotes literacy and reading. It's a national organization, and we have a chapter here within our state. And essentially it is that we as pediatricians, in my practice, I do this every day. For every well checkup exam that I see children from 6 months of age to 5 years of age, we give them a book. A book that is appropriate for the age, obviously. And many times, this is my enjoyable part of the visit, when I have time, I actually read the book to them. And they think it is the coolest thing. It says, so Dr. Jesus read me a book. I said, yes, I did. Yes, I read you a book. Now, it's not going to happen every single time because I may not have time other times. But it's really enjoyable. And they actually anticipate, when we started giving them books, they anticipate that they're going to get the book at the next checkup. Because that's, if you think about 6 months to 5 years of age, they get, I think, about 8 or 10 books in the course of it. But the whole purpose is for the parents to see that this is a very important thing to do. Read to your children out loud. We have another program, for example, the Obesity Committee. We devised the 5210 Arizona Way to Go. 5210 means 5 servings of fruits and vegetables per day, 2 hours maximum of media or video
screen
watching.
Time.
If it's screen time, mm-hmm. Thank you. 5 to 1 hour of actual activity. You know, activity is it's not very well defined by some kids. You know, I've asked kids to go, so what do you do? Oh, I swim, Dr. Jesus. So how many laps do you do? I don't do laps. So you just get in the water and try. That's not activity. And zero, it's zero to few sweets. So that's a program that we actually developed in our chapter. They got national recognition as well. So that impacts the kids. The sad reality, as you and I know, over 60% of our kids are overweight, of the population is overweight, and maybe 30% are obese. So we have to nip it in the bud, and we are the prime group of people to do this. So that's what the chapter has developed as well. And we're spreading the word with all the practices, so we're all doing the same thing.
Does that put a pediatrician in a tough spot?
Yes. It does because, for example, for legislation, I'll answer that question with vaccines. We unfortunately had to go to the legislature to make sure that we pediatricians get appropriate payment for vaccines. And I wish we had not needed to do that. But when the insurance company are not listening to us, and we as practitioners say, we can't afford this anymore. And we know it's the right thing to do for our patients. It puts us in a very tough predicament. I mean, I've heard comments like, oh, of course, the pediatricians are doing this because they want to make more money. I just told you we're losing money on vaccines. No, we just want to break even. And that's the reality to it. We're not becoming millionaires over giving vaccines. Vaccines in general are the most important medical miracle that has occurred ever, if you really look at it. There is no other modality in medicine that has actually made such an impact. We haven't had, for example, smallpox since 1976 in the face of this earth because of vaccination. When I graduated from medical school, you had mentioned that when I was in medical school, I was very naive, and I remember thinking, gosh, would it be cool if 25 years from now we're not going to have diabetes, we're not going to have cystic fibrosis, asthma, and all this stuff. We still have them. I mean, I was very naive in thinking that was going to go away. No, we've done a lot of good things about it, but we've not eradicated those things. With vaccines, we can. But it puts us in a very tough position with the legislators and the state officials and the insurance companies as well. So that's the last part of medicine. You asked me initially as well, what's the hardest part of medicine? It's that. Enjoying and seeing the patients, we love that part. The business end of it that we have to take care of, it's the hardest.
Do you ever have families that are opposed to vaccines?
Yes, we do.
If you could briefly speak to the bad rap that vaccines have gotten and the reluctance of some people to vaccinate.
We actually have less now because of the retraction of Dr. Wakefield's article in The Lancet that basically said that MMR was linked to autism. This was in 1998, so this is how long this discussion has occurred. Unfortunately, bad press and bad media is always more powerful than good press and good media. You and I know that. You work in this field. So what I tell parents just is give me the opportunity to explain to you our side of the story. You know, there's always the group, the anti-vaccine groups are there. They're the less loud now because they're realizing, well, you know what, this guy was wrong. And I'm talking about the Jenny McCarthys of the world and all those people. When you tell them that there is some proof, there's ample proof that vaccines do work, and then they're not as overwhelming the immune system. That's one of the things that I always get. Oh, it's overwhelming the immune system. I said, no, it doesn't. You know, we're exposed to daily anywhere between 2,000 and 6,000 antigen viruses every day from what we touch, we eat, all the stuff that we do. If you add up the entire vaccine schedule from literally birth to about 10 years of age, you inject in one's body about 150 antigens. That's not overwhelming the immune system. So what we do, in short, is try to inform them of the actual benefits of vaccination. Because I ask them as well, tell me why would it be better if you don't vaccinate? If you can prove to me that that's the best thing to do, then we should never vaccinate anyone. You know that that's not true.
And so has that been a successful approach?
Yes, it has. I pride myself that I'm very successful. And in fact, sometimes when a patient goes in the room and my medical assistant comes out, I go, they don't believe in vaccines. I said, well, let me talk to them. You have to be very respectful of their needs, by the way. You cannot push someone to do what they don't want to do, and I would never do that. I give them the information, and when they understand our point of view, I am very successful. I guess over 90, 95% of the time, I come out and says, yes, they do want vaccines. And many times my medical assistant tells me, what did you say to them? I said, I told them the truth. I told them real data, real information.
Let's talk a little bit about your own family. Tell me a little bit about them and what they have taught you that helps you in your practice.
Well, I have a beautiful family. I'm obviously very biased. My wife is a pharmacist, but she became a pharmacist later in life. When I moved to New York, and my wife got pregnant when we moved at the same, talk about, a conflict of issues when we first moved to New York. We just got married, and I even told her that this is great, we're going to have a great time there. Yeah, a week later, she's pregnant, and then pregnant with twins. So my twins were born in New York. I have identical twins that were born in New York. They're now 21 years of age, graduating from the University of Arizona. I'm very proud of that. And I have an almost 16-year-old teenager, all girls, mind you. They are the light of my life. That is what I do, My wife, God love her, because of her, I became a pediatrician. And because she said, honey, if you're going to, you know, become a doctor, residency is not easy. Anybody can tell you that it's not easy. She said, I'll stop working. I'll take care of the kids. And until my youngest, if I remember correctly, my youngest started elementary school. She went back to school, got her, the prereqs and went into pharmacy. And then I backed her up. And it wasn't easy for me to do. I was working full time. And she was in school and taking care of the kids. So I became a pediatrician and daddy and mommy at the same time. So I have the highest respect for all moms who do this 24/7. When she finally graduated, said, okay, you can have your job back. You know, because there was a lot of work that we had to do. My girls have taught me a lot. They've taught me to relax. Daddy says, chill, relax, Dad. You know, they're very modern as well. They want me to read books like the Harry Potter series. I don't have time to read all this stuff because I read so many medical journals because I have to. But I've actually started doing that, you know, and all it's all about relax. It's, Daddy, you take your job too seriously. You know, it's like, chill. And it really, I have changed because of them in a good way. You know, the stuff that I used to worry about, I don't worry about anymore. You know, I enjoy time with them. That's the most important thing. And I tell my parents, the patients that I take care of, do the same thing. It says those memories you're creating. I'll very briefly tell you one thing. When they were in prep school, I would pick them up every single Friday, at lunchtime, and we had sushi every Friday for 2 years. That was my quality time with them. And I love that. I really, truly love that because it was just us, my twins and me. And I'm doing it now with my youngest as well for the same reason.
And so you tell your parents of your patients.
Quality time. Spend it with them. Everything we do in life is about them, by spending with the family. It's not about trying to get the biggest house or the nicest car and all that stuff. You realize very quickly that means absolutely nothing. It's your family. And I treat my patients the same way that I would love somebody to treat my own kids. It's as simple as that.
Check out our June issue, where you'll find a collection of family-friendly resorts for vacation time this summer and a story about the changing role of local libraries. It's all at our newly redesigned website, RaisingArizonaKids.com. I'm Vicki Belint. Thanks for listening.
Raising Arizona Kids Radio is a Small Change production. All rights reserved. This material may not be broadcast or redistributed without permission. Ooh.